and welcome to the Hear It podcast. I'm your host, Rebecca Roberts, and I'll be speaking with guests about the campaigns, insights and ideas to better engage youth audiences. I really hope you like it. This episode, I'm delighted to be welcoming Ruth Dale, founder of Social Insight Marketing, a behaviour change marketing specialist. With over 20 years experience across NHS, local and national government, Ruth has worked on almost every social and health issue out there. As well as her infamous behaviour change boot camps, she also hosts a behaviour change marketing bootcamp podcast. God, what an intro, Ruth. Thanks for coming on the Hear It podcast.
Oh, that's amazing. Thank you so much for having me, Rebecca.
I thought I'd start at the beginning, kind of stripping things right back, to tell us a bit more about what behaviour change marketing is and why it could prove invaluable, particularly when we're looking at youth audiences.
When we use the term, we're really referring to three core disciplines. So we look at behavioural science as a tool, design thinking as a tool, and social marketing. Really, there's these three core disciplines that offer tools and techniques for marketers and communicators to really shift beyond awareness to activate change. But I hesitate because behavioural science is definitely the popular kid at school. But that is relatively new. During COVID, it just rose in popularity. And I was working for Public Health England. My role was to coordinate the south of England. And I sat between central government and the local resilience forums. And I would be synergizing messages, and all we'd hear suddenly was, oh, we need a behaviour change marketing campaign. But no one really knew what that was. Everyone tended to lean quite heavily on behavioural science as a tool. Then it just grew and grew because it is impactful, it is effective. And actually, there's some really key techniques that we can learn quite easily and simply. So what is behavioural science? If you could take a moment just to imagine an elephant and a rider. So imagine a lovely elephant and you're sitting on top, riding around, having a wonderful day, thinking you're fully in control of your life. Well, behavioral science really highlights that actually you're probably not as in control as you think you are, because the elephant and the rider is an analogy of your brain. Your brain is mostly the elephant, and that is where your subconscious thinking and all your emotions sit. And the rider is your conscious brain. In behavioral science, they call it system one and system two. So the elephant is called system one and the rider is called system two. Now, the elephant and rider analogy was developed by a psychologist called Jonathan Haidt, but it was brought to my attention by an amazing behavioral economist called Melina Palmer. And I just couldn't get it out of my head. And I think it's a wonderful way of describing making behavioral science real for everyone. So you can understand just how powerful, if you can suddenly understand your audience's elephant as well as their conscious decisions, then, you know, you can take things so much further. You can be so much more impactful. You can resonate more. As humans, we make about 35,000 decisions a day. Now, the rider, you and me, we think we're in control of making all of those decisions. But unfortunately, behavioral scientists tell us that actually, we're probably making about 5% of those decisions. 95% of your decisions and your audience's decisions and the young people out there who you might be trying to engage with, their decisions are very much led by the elephant, where all the biases sit. So that's where you get all your social norming, the endowment effect, all the cognitive biases that have risen to popularity. But we all think we're the rider. There is this massive understanding that if you could just remember that we are not rational beings, that we cannot simply provide information and then expect people to just follow it and to make the best use of it and make the best decision they can and ultimately to be a rational, sensible person. Behavioral science evidenced and proved that actually we're irrational first. So we should be kinder, more empathetic to our audiences, but not just assume that just simply because you've shared some knowledge that your desired outcome or your desired behavior will happen. There's a wonderful behavioral scientist called Dan Ariely, and he has written a book called Predictably Irrational. So where the behavioral science is going is they're saying, look, yes, this elephant, a nightmare, control freak like me. Oh my God, I really thought I was in control of myself. But these biases are often predictably irrational. So that's what behavioral scientists do. They often work on quite longitudinal studies, but they're saying, look, we can understand these biases. We can understand our elephant and we can start predicting what people will do. At our Behavior Change Marketing Bootcamp, what we try to do is sort of give a really deep overview of what behavioral science is. So as a marketer, you can understand which part of it you need to use. Because behavioral science as an academic discipline is relatively new, and it draws on cognitive psychology, behavioral economics, neuroscience. So if you are a busy communicator, can be quite scary. And within behavioral science itself, there's so many specialisms, but actually behavioral science does kind of underpin the whole campaign cycle. So there's different techniques that are really valuable at different times. And we try to help people navigate what they need to learn so they can get to learn it quite quick and fast and ultimately use it and get good at it.
Of course, for young people who are not only dealing with this, that and hormones, that is a really tough thing to deal with when you think about that analogy in decision making. And I spoke to the rescue agency, who I know you know.
Oh yeah, they're amazing.
And they were sort of saying the same around teens and this whole kind of identity bit and this wanting to push boundaries and kind of rebel against parents and, you know, people who've kind of been in charge of them, I guess, which is quite a natural progression. But that is really hard when you're trying to think about how to engage them.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And so just one thing to flag as well is just because it's decisions might be irrational doesn't mean they're bad. And just because you're the rider and you think, oh, if I make a very conscious, deliberate decision, culturally, we kind of think, oh, well, that means it's a better decision. So if I'm, you know, paying attention, I might make better decisions. But actually, these biases impact us across our brain. They don't just live in system one. You can make as many mistakes, you know, when you're very, very focused as much as you can, like these hardwired heuristics. And hardwired heuristics have evolved over millennia. This is how humans survived. And horror movies use them all the time. You know, when you're frightened, you might, you know, hiding, you might hold your hand over your mouth to hide your breath. And that comes from, you know, the hunter-gatherer stage. So there's all of these heuristics, but then there's the cultural and the learned ones as well. And I think that's essential when you're talking, engaging with youth, because understanding their cultural environment and their social norms is absolutely key. You know, we learn through mirror neurons in our brain, we learn by copying, and they are learning how to navigate society. They're learning how they want their identity to be. But they're learning from what they see and hear. So times have changed so much for young people because now the breadth of what they see is so much broader. Parents have very little control over, you know, what's incoming through the social media. You know, you can be seeing things affecting people all around the world, as well as, you know, if you think about the 1950s, it might just be, I live in Devon, it could just be in your town, your village. You know, groups, influences have always been massively important in the teenage years, but now they're online and global. So there is definitely something about using behavioral science to understand not only the individual sense of identity that cognitive psychology brings, but also the social and cultural identity that they're forming for sort of youth audiences. The social norming part is cognitive bias is absolutely key, and the herding bias, because it's where we look for social proof when we're unsure. So we're much more likely to look at what other people are doing when we need to make a decision, if we're frightened, nervous, unsure. And I think the teenage years are often so transitional. There's so much uncertainty, you know, really in a deep identity level uncertainty. And you are looking outward to see who's doing what and what's socially accepted. And, you know, that need to be part of the group. Young people, we say they're emotional, and it's though one is as though emotions are bad things, but also this is neuroscience saying this is the brain telling you need to be part of that group because that's how we survive. So this isn't your child being all emotional, you know, the whole, oh, if they told you to jump off the cliff, would you do it type thing. I'm sure I got told that a dozen times, but actually neuroscience has proven that actually this is a real psychological need. It's, and to stand up against your peers is really, really tough. You will have error signals in your brain telling you don't do that, and they're greater the more uncertain you are, and they'll lessen with confidence.
I think that's really fascinating. And also, I know when we last caught up, We were talking about understanding when it's a particular campaign, understanding where that youth audience is really key, because we can project what our understanding is, I guess, with any audience, but particularly with youth audiences. Can you tell us a bit more about some of the issues you've directly targeted, a behaviour change approach among young people?
I've got two examples. One goes back way back when we were working on a skin cancer campaign, trying to get young people to protect themselves. But of course, it's a very, very long-term outcome. And who gives a monkey's, like we've just said, much more concerned about being part of the group, you know, forming your own identity. And what was absolutely key was to understand how we could communicate this message to activate the actual behaviours of wearing a hat or putting the cream on in a way that young people could not only understand it, but would take action. So it was very much about understanding the immediate reward. Behavioural science is really clear, and all of health communications really need to remember that people don't really care about long-term rewards. So with our skin cancer work, we actually worked with some beauty therapists in that were training at a sixth form college. They led the engagement with the young people. They then led the solution. They designed it. And we kind of bringing in the science, the methodology. So it was replicable and it was scalable and it was cost effective. And it was so impactful. We used T-testing before and after the intervention to capture intention to change. And we invested in a scanner. So this was quite a while ago. Tech isn't as good then as it is now. But people were scanning their faces and their hands to actually see damage. We had to make it really, really real and explain, you know, sunburn is not the same as a burn that you get from an oven. Your skin cannot recover. And of course, the whole beauty side became much more important for men as well as women. It took off so much. And because we were using behavioral science as a framework, we were able to package it. And lots of sixth form colleges were picking it up because we could prove the intention to change. We could then win funding. You can apply for things. You can say, look, it's working. It morphed from a tiny little sixth form college in Devon across the whole of the Southwest. And at one point, there was just a whole skin cancer campaign, all driven by young people, designed by them. And then that went on to win the HSJ Award for Social Marketing nationally. We like always feel like such frauds because it was about young people telling us what mattered to them. So they had the answers. Your answers are in your insight. You have to hear the voice of your audience. And it was a million times more effective than anything we could have done. And you know what? It never even mentioned skin cancer. The call to actions were all around protecting yourself for your beauty and everything. I loved that one. And then a more recent one was we took a combi approach and we did a sexual health study with young people where we designed the topic guides. We designed everything through the behavioral science model combi, which was developed by UCL. Susan Michi and Professor Robert West and Lou Atkins. And we used that to really deep dive our qualitative work. We needed to ensure a real clear robustness with this one. So the other one was more co-creation, you know, very, very low budget. This one, actually, the investment was upfront. We need to deeply understand why we've got a significant increase in STIs in this age group. You know, is that because they're not wearing condoms? Probably yes. But you can't go in with assumptions. You just need to go in and listen and talk to people. Yeah, really sensitive subject, sexual health. You've got to be really careful. And also your work's got to be open to scrutiny from all sorts of people within the sort of NHS system, a local government system, to get on board with your findings and to say, actually, I'm going to hold back my biases. Perhaps I hold about young people and listen and learn from the work that we've done. And we actually videoed the young people for this one so they could give their messages directly to sexual health planners to help them improve the services.
What frameworks or approaches are particularly helpful that we can link in the notes when you're wanting to understand a kind of an issue or a current behaviour?
So I'd say Combi is top of the class at the moment. It was the behavioural science model that was underpinned the global response really to COVID pandemic. It's very trusted, very respected, and it's very easy to use. As a communicator, or if you're planning strategically, if you can invest upfront, the work I do tends to feed in quite strategic. So it goes into work programs, so it goes across all work streams, as well as marketing and comms. Because ideally, you do want everyone on the same page with who the audience is. I always say, if you Asked, I live in Sidmouth and Devon. If you ask around here what a young person is, people will say 55. If you ask in Bedford where I grew up, it's a 15-year-old. You can't just use these general vague terms for people to think that they're all talking about the same people in the first place. If you can invest and do a full COMBI diagnosis, that's amazing. And if you are looking to find solutions, you use COMBI with the behavior change wheel. Also, what's brilliant is if you are on a work program like that and you are the marketing person, you get given 30 pages of this is your target audience, this is what they think, feel, these are the barriers, this is what motivate them. So often I would do that up front before it goes out to creative brief. But you can also just use it as a really quick and dirty prompt tool. I would really always recommend, just asking, is my audience capable? Do they have the opportunity to do what I want them to do? And how motivated are they? And if you don't know the basics to those questions, you really need to find out. One really good way of finding out if you haven't got any money is empathy mapping. Empathy mapping is a design thinking tool. I will often use it pre-COMBI and it's free. Okay. And we can hook you up to someone called Dave Gray's empathy map. He just did it and gave it out to everyone for free. Use this empathy map. And it's asking people, what do they think? What do they see? What do they feel? And I always say, look, it's okay to have gaps in that, because sometimes understanding what you don't know about people is as important. So, and you can just do that in 2 hours with your team or on your own, or if you've got some stakeholders. The next stage is maybe, what have I found out in the empathy map? And then ask, are they capable? Do they have the opportunities? And are they motivated? And motivation is a really tricky one. That's where the system one and system two really comes in. How much do you know about the elephant and how much do you know about the rider? And we are very guilty of just talking to the rider in our marketing and comms. And people don't like that. That pushes people into a sort of stressful state. Things are too complicated. User journeys are just quite frankly rubbish. Behavioral science is really clear that the human brain is quite lazy. We will always take the easy option. So you've got COMBI and empathy mapping together there. You can do it on its own in 2 hours, or you can do it in a whole month study like I do. And then if you just use EAST, EAST is a fantastic framework developed by the Behavioral Insights Unit. And I use that at design stage. If you have just been given a brief and you kind of want to get going, EAST is to make things easy, make them attractive, make them social, make them timely. And you just use it as a checklist. Behavioral science will give you loads of tips to intrinsically motivate people without having to give external incentives. The difference between what I say I'm going to do in the morning and the evening is vastly different. Hence, Netflix cake eating versus morning muesli. We do change throughout the day and our seasons and our weeks, and any social media scheduler out there will completely get that. And in our behavior change marketing boot camps, I always just say, do you know what? Just ask yourself, how aware is my audience? So is my audience even aware of what we want them to do? Do they give a monkey? So that's, we call it the AAA. What's their attitude? If they don't care, they're not going to do it anyway. And then can they do it? And I think that's ability. So awareness, attitude and ability and equals action. And honestly, I often just say that in my head all the time, because sometimes you could just be talking to attitude. Lots of things people do know. So you can't assume young people don't have any knowledge. Is it just they just don't care? Or as in sexual health, do they have no knowledge of STIs? In actual fact, raising awareness is your first and very important step.
Can you tell us a little bit more about how you might recruit the right people and how you might identify them, and also a bit about that trauma-informed questioning?
We use a trauma-informed approach with our sexual health work, and we work with, we have two behavioural scientists and one of them is a clinical health psychologist. So she's kind of specialises in that in her clinical work. First of all, you can use COMBI to structure your questions. We have a free guide. I can link it up for you that actually outlines some of the core questions, but it was much more about the process for being trauma-informed. So one, the way we recruited, very open, very transparent at all times, giving people the opportunity to withdraw consent before the interviews. Then techniques about asking people to repeat back what we were saying, taking really clear steps to really highlight that you might say yes, that you want to do this now. But actually, after I've asked 2 or 3 questions, if you change your mind, you don't even have to tell me why. You can just walk away from the interview. just giving so much permission and control to the person. It is an authority position when you're an interviewer and you've got a young adult and you're talking something as sensitive as sexual health. So it's really important that you give them a sense of control and ownership. So real transparency around then they actually had to reply via email and confirm in writing they were happy. So we had multiple permission levels built through. Then at the end, we had built in time to debrief. Did any questions bother you? You know, was there anything that was interested you or anything you would, you know, you prefer anyone not to know? And if people disclosed trauma or sexual abuse or anything within the interviews, then we had a really clear process set out in order how to progress that and also let them know from the very beginning that if they do express anything, their care, their safety is our primary concern. So we are obligated to tell the appropriate person that, can help them. There's kind of two approaches as well. There was the young adults that we knew perhaps because they were working with services already that we spoke to. So we knew that actually they perhaps had had negative traumatic experiences, but they were in a caring environment and safe hands. But we recruited through football teams, parent groups. Then you don't know. What if, you know, 20-year-old adult expresses some concerns or worries or reveals something? So it's that real safeguarding element, especially if they have disclosed learning disabilities, in which case, you know, your safeguarding goes up to age 25. So it's just making sure all of that was in place. We're just really lucky. We have this amazing Alison, her name is, and as a practicing clinical psychologist, she's just in such a good place. She can recognize when she's looking at people what they're saying and doing, and also allowing people to go completely off topic if they want to. And if the interview closes with nothing, that's absolutely fine as well. So yeah, I'd say trauma is definitely about permissions and sense of control and a really solid debrief at the end where people can withdraw everything they've said if they want to.
Another thing that cropped up when we spoke previously was referring to kind of awareness raising the right way. So I'm vocal about being anti when people just go, yeah, we're just going to raise awareness. And they mean it in the sense of clicks, or they're just putting out into the ether, that's them thinking the job's done. You know, when you're trying to influence and change a behavior, making someone aware of it is actually a really key part of that, but you must look at the measures you're implying. So yeah, just expand on that, because I think awareness gets a bad rep, but I think it's really important people think about it in kind of like an end-to-end proper way.
With behavior change marketing, the goal is behavior change. So you have to have identified your goal. Then you need to know what the steps you're expecting people to take are. And then your communications and marketing, the job of the marketing strategy is to get people to take those steps, one of which will most likely be awareness. So it's understanding where awareness fits in your strategy and where it's stepping onto. So where's the awareness taking people? What often happens is that we don't have very clear measurable behavior change goals to start with, and the pressure just to deliver means that everyone goes, oh, we'll just get it out there. I feel bad for awareness. It's like, you know, when you see these trend things, behavior change, behavioral science has gone up, awareness has gone down. So if you take a behavioral science approach in your marketing, you're going to commit to reaching the elephant and the rider. So perhaps the awareness of the more practical information sits in the rider, using the emotion to get people to connect. And then you want them to know something so they can actually do it. Whether there's a big push to get people to use buses, they need to look up the bus timetable. You know, there are some stuff people need to do. For me, it's like understanding where awareness fits in my strategy, how I'm measuring it and what depth it has. And really, if you're coming in at a place where everyone's already aware, things like breastfeeding, just leave poor mums alone. I always think, you know, often we know what we should be doing, in which case you're probably raising awareness of the wrong thing. Awareness can sometimes actually just be, and I think unfortunately the environmental messages fall prey to this a lot, just about the dangers and the disasters and the problem. So you're just simply raising awareness about a problem. You haven't raised awareness about the practical steps and empowered people to create the change. Behavioral science is really clear that if you stay stuck in the problem and you're simply raising awareness of the policy goal, which a lot of your bosses will love, the stakeholders love it because that's where they live. then you are actually just, you're stopping change. You're keeping people completely stuck. It's called negative social norms. And it just really means you're talking about the wrong thing. And I think that's where awareness gets a bad rep. And people go into the whole nanny state thing. Stop telling me what I need to do. I know I shouldn't be eating this much sugar. You know, I know I should be going for a run. And it's just, you're having the wrong conversation.
Are there any books, podcasts or talks that you'd recommend that could help us better understand behaviour change and or engaging youth audiences?
Nancy Harhut has just published Using Behavioural Science in Marketing. It's amazing. She's a marketer that uses behavioural science. And so in there is all examples of her work. The person I read most is Melina Palmer. She's a behavioural economist, but she's a marketer background. And she'll tell you much more about the behavioural economics side and the sciencey side, which is really incredibly interesting. I mentioned Dan Ariely, any of his books, but the birth of behavioural science, I'd be remiss not to say, was Daniel Kahneman, the godfather of behavioural science, Thinking Fast and Slow. So if you haven't read that, you've got to start there anyway. And actually, it's a really simple read. And then there's one I've just started, which is called Decoded by Phil Barden. I'm just looking at it now. And that's brilliant again. And it's much more practical.
Lovely. We'll link all of those in the show notes. And just finally, what's the one stereotype about young people that you think everyone needs to throw in the bin?
I would say just there is no such thing as young people. Just stop using that phrase. Because when we did our work, we had mums with three children at 19 responsible for other human beings. Incredible, incredible people being described as young people. You know, they're managing rent, bills. That's a very different to a 19-year-old who's just perhaps coming out of A-levels, you know, living with mum and dad. So I would say just try and see beyond that phrase. Don't assume anything about them. Go and actually, you know, segment them and look at perhaps life stage as opposed to just age.
That's a really, really good one. Thank you so much for coming on today. It's been lovely speaking to you.
Oh, no, my pleasure, Rebecca. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Hear It podcast. If you like what you heard, please rate, review and subscribe as it really helps others find us. You can also follow us on Twitter @Hear It Podcast or drop us a message by emailing info@threadandfable.com.